Hello, everyone. Hope everyone has had a pleasantly eventful summer and hope everyone is doing great. This month on Healthy Intersections, we're going to take a trip down memory lane for the month of August. Dr. Gregory Stevens has written a few retrospective pieces on reproductive health care, prescription drugs, and COVID. Then we decided to look to the future and switch it up by looking at a post again, written by Dr. Gregory Stevens, Medicare will negotiate prescription drug prices in 4 years. We're once again enlightened with the process of how the Department of Health and Human Services will work on negotiating drug prices, slowly, albeit surely. Stop by to read the article on the medical care blog called Healthy Intersections and drop your thoughts on what you think about this process and its future outlook. On that note, of affordable healthcare and accessibility in today's economic times, we have some medical care journal articles published in September. I'm going to highlight a few titles. Our authors from France have written an article called The Economic Burden of Disease in France from the National Health Insurance Perspective. The authors aim to identify health priorities and gain a better understanding of trends in healthcare expenditures in France. This is refreshing to note in comparison to the American perspectives on healthcare. We have quite a few articles on the American perspectives as well this month, which include an analysis of affordable healthcare in the U.S., adoption of patient engagement strategies in the U.S., and how that pertains to healthcare quantity and quality, and the association of patient and system-level factors with the social determinants of health screening. And as always, we want to know what you think, so head to the journal and blog to read and drop your thoughts. Happy fall, everyone. Now for today's podcast episode, we have one of our editors, Dr. Jess Williams, speaking to Dr. Cheryl Connor on her article, Advancing Public Health Interventions to Address the Harms of the Carceral System.
This month, we are going to hear from Cheryl Connor, who is a clinical associate professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and a dedicated member of the American Public Health Association. Welcome to Healthy Intersection, Cheryl.
Thanks for having me.
This month, you are the lead author on a commentary in medical care on behalf of the End Police Violence Collective. Can you tell me a little bit about the collective and what it hopes to accomplish?
Yes. So the End Police Violence Collective is a group of public health researchers, teachers, graduate students, nonprofit leaders, community organizers, clinicians like myself, who want the field of public health to recognize and mobilize around the abolition of policing and incarceration. And we formed through working on the APHA policy statement addressing law enforcement violence as a public health issue. And then we've continued on doing more advocacy and policy work.
That's great. Thank you. And so I saw that your commentary was based on a new APHA policy about the health harms of carceral systems. Can you explain a little bit about what the main goals of that policy are for our listeners?
So the main goals of the policy statement were to point out that incarceration in all of its various forms is antithetical to health and to offer concrete steps to move towards abolition of incarceration. And so we provide a lot of evidence for the health harms, which are both individual to families and to communities in the commentary and in the policy statement. And then we really try to give these concrete steps, which kind of sort of boil down to decarceration, which is, getting people out of jails and prisons and detention centers. And then we also think it's really important for public safety and to make this decarceration effort successful to have a divest money and resources from policing and jails and prisons and into the social determinants of health, such as housing, employment, and education. And then we will have to build together non-carceral measures, such as like restorative justice practices, to make sure that we have accountability, safety, and well-being for those that are harmed by interpersonal violence, for example.
That's really helpful. Thank you. I did like seeing in your commentary how you looked at the health effects for sort of families and communities, as well as individuals sort of in the carceral system. So I thought that was a really nice touch for the commentary. Thanks. And a little bit unique. So one question I had was, have the realities of the COVID-19 pandemic changed anything about your work on carceral systems?
Yes. Actually, it's funny. We had started writing a policy statement on the harms of incarceration and how to approach it with an, with evidence-based lens. And then, but we didn't, the deadline for APHA policy statements is very early. So we'd kind of been like, let's like perfect this and submit next year. And then the COVID pandemic hit. And we saw the extraordinarily devastating effects of COVID in jails and prisons, where incarcerated people were twice as likely to die from COVID than non-incarcerated people. And also it's just like the perfect communal setting for rapid spread of infectious disease. And so then that really spurred us to submit it as a late breaker in the summer of 2020. So we kind of resurrected the statement we'd been working on and then added a lot more about COVID to it. So the COVID pandemic made a huge difference. I think the COVID pandemic also showed us, because in many places there was rapid decarceration. People, in different places around the US and also internationally tried hard to empty their jails and prisons. And we did not see an attendant rise in crime. And so you kind of had like a little bit of proof from the COVID pandemic that this strategy was also not going to harm public safety.
And have you seen any of that decarceration sort of continue or get sort of taken back? Like, did that sort of stop happening, or is that sort of still ongoing?
No, it was pretty quickly reversed. Okay. And actually, by the time we were revising this for, final adoption in the winter of, in spring of 2021, mm-hmm. we had seen jails and prisons back up to their pre-pandemic levels.
Oh, wow.
So it really was reversed pretty quickly.
Okay. And another thing you mentioned I sort of wanted to talk a little bit about was, we've had a ton of episodes about social determinants of health here at Healthy Intersections. And you mentioned a couple of things that you think that the sort of the End Police Violence Collective and others have sort of suggested as types of sort of social investments that could be beneficial in terms of reducing the impact of the carceral systems on people's lives and things like that. But I was wondering, do you have any idea of sort of how this investment might be directed, or what types of processes could be used to figure out basically where to put the money?
Wow, that's a really good question. A very broad question. And I think that when we think about this, if you read, anyone in the abolition space like Miriam Kaba or Andrea Ritchie, like, they will talk about how what really ensures public safety is well-resourced communities. We know what like safe communities look like, and it looks like well-off suburban, often communities. Here in Chicago, it looks like the north side of the city. So we would recommend trying to put resources into under-resourced communities, and then to make those communities as safe as these other ones that already exist. So some of the things that I think are really crucial to that are housing and employment, as well as really robust public education. And I think there's a lot of ways for communities to envision and act out job creation for the public good. So for example, I was thinking about this in our city of Chicago, that if we invested more of our resources away from the Chicago Police Department, away from the Cook County Jail, and instead into the Chicago Parks Department, the Chicago Public Schools, and the Chicago Transportation Authority, then we would have, we would create a lot of jobs, right? To do upkeep, to do programming, to mm-hmm. have, to drive the buses and the trains, to repair them. We could create a lot of jobs by investing mm-hmm. in those programs. And then those programs would also like make our communities better, safer, and healthier. So that's sort of, how I would picture it like in my local area doing
that's
that.
That's a great example. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great example. And I like the way you sort of brought in that, communities might have an impact on it as well, rather than it sort of being a top-down approach.
Oh, definitely. Right. Yeah. The people, we should always be involving the local stakeholders who know, what they need in their own community. And I felt like this summer with the lifeguard shortage, it just felt like if we offered higher pay for those positions, we mm-hmm. would fill those positions, and then the pools mm-hmm. could have been open, and instead a lot of them weren't. Mm-hmm. And that was really, I'm sure, awful for a lot of neighborhoods. So,
definitely. I mean, especially with all the sort of heat and all the other sort of The heat waves and everything everyone had experienced this summer. So another thing I kind of wanted to touch on just briefly, you did mention sort of the principles of restorative justice. And I know I've read, and I'm sure other people have, sort of how this might work in kind of a school-based setting with sort of younger people. But can you give a few examples of what some of these sort of non-carceral measures for accountability, safety, and well-being might be sort of at a broader scale or for adults?
Yes, definitely. I'm going to define restorative justice for the listeners who may not have read anything. So restorative justice is a non-punitive, non-retributive process to address interpersonal harm. And it centers the survivors of the harm and bringing everyone together who's been affected to decide collectively how to heal and repair the harm. And yes, you're right. This has been tried most when you like look to the literature and the evidence base in school settings and also in the juvenile detention system. And not as much in the adult system, although certainly it could be translated there. And what it looks like in the juvenile detention system, is, you know, a lot of times it's really just bringing the person who is affected and the youth, as well as community members and families together to discuss sort of what do we think repairing this harm looks like. But it can also be things like giving someone a caution and then diverting them into mental health treatment or substance use treatment if that's part of it. And I think that sometimes when you talk about restorative justice, you know, one of the main pushbacks that people give is that, you know, well, what about like the survivors? Are you, you know, you have this pie in the sky idea, and the survivors of interpersonal violence really, you know, what do they actually want? And you can't speak for them. Well, first of all, many of us are victims of various crimes, from property crimes to violent crimes. But there is actually a lot of data that out there that shows that survivors themselves really want, they want to repair the harm by getting accountability. They're much, you know, 2-to-1, they favor like restitution and rehabilitation over retribution. And so I think that like, we actually are listening to survivors. And that was like a big part of our policy statement, was pointing out that actually we're following the lead of the people who are most affected by interpersonal violence. And, you know, you can think about it within your own family or within your own school. You know, you probably don't want that kid that got in a fight with your kid just suspended out of the blue. You want them to get the help they need for the family issues they're having, for the trauma they experienced as a childhood, for the substance use issues of their parents, whatever it may be, right? You don't really just want to be like, you know, kick them out, lock them up, you know? And like, so trying to picture that and do that on a broader scale. And I do think that actually recently we have seen some moves towards that with the opioid epidemic and trying to do more drug treatment and then just always locking people up, which is a good first step.
That's great. Those are really good examples. So moving on to sort of what are some of the sort of most pressing policy changes that you think sort of individuals and our listeners can sort of support now to sort of move towards these broader goals?
Oh yeah, there's so much stuff we can all be doing. well, I think that there's, some low hanging fruit and stuff that has already been started in some places in the country would be things like, eliminating cash bail and pretrial detention. These are, things that disproportionately impact Black and Brown people and poor people, and are also before anyone has even been like convicted of actually any sort of, crime. And then I think that we should also be thinking more, and some places have done this, about like decriminalizing certain stuff. There's a lot of things that really we need to treat with prevention and not retribution, not incarceration, such as like possession of substances, homelessness, sex work, things like this, that like, we just need to decriminalize those things so we don't feed people into the criminal legal system. And then I think that like, depending on, you know, so you could be advocating for those kind of policies in your local government area. And then I think we also, but a lot of us probably are clinicians and researchers, and you can find ways to like intervene on these issues in your research, in your work, in your classes, bringing them up, helping public health recognize this is a big problem and think about, you know, activating people to work on it. And then even like in my hospital, for example, there is an interaction sometimes between law enforcement and patients. And so like also imagining hyper-locally in your job, in your school, what does that look like? And can we, you know, disrupt that? So those would be some of my, some of our ideas.
Those are great. And do you have any sort of resources where folks who want to get sort of more or become more aware of kind of these issues and like what they can do?
The website is endingpoliceviolence.com. We have a lot of references there. Also, I think the policy statement we wrote for APHA, which is available on at APHA website, has a ton of really good resources and references too. And some of them, I think if you go through them, you can find some great like nonprofits and NGOs that are doing work around this and have like data and great infographics that could be used in classes or at like local board meetings and things like that. So I would direct people to our policy statement at APHA and also to the endingpoliceviolence.com.
That's great. And we'll definitely include those links with the blog post where this podcast will be located.
Thanks. Well,
thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us today.
No, it was my pleasure.
Really appreciate
you.
It.
No, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jess.
That wraps up this month's Healthy Intersections podcast. Please tune in again next month for more exciting topics. Thank you for listening.